Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about better understanding others and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. Please, if you like it, share it with your friends and leave me a review on iTunes or another platform. I'd greatly appreciate it. In this episode, I talk with applied social psychologist Abe Rutschick. We talk about a study he did that showed that people were more willing to kill ladybugs when they were distant from that happening. This is an interesting and topical study in how it relates to all sorts of things that we do at a distance, from the military using drones to attack people, to us being more likely to treat each other badly when talking to each other online, to being more cold and removed when considering distant and abstract ethical problems, and to the food we eat and the products we buy, and how we're less likely to consider the animal cruelty or human cruelty or other harms involved when that is so far removed from us. We also talk about some research Abe did regarding autonomous vehicles and how people reach moral judgments about who's at fault for what those self-driving vehicles do. And we talk about some studies involving poker that Abe has been involved with. I'll have links to all the studies discussed in the page for this episode at behavior-podcast.com if you want to check those out. A little more about Abe. Abe Rutschick is a professor of psychology at California State University, Northridge. He is broadly an applied social psychologist. His earlier work was on social perception, with a focus on the way people perceive political groups. He also conducted research on the non-conscious influence of everyday objects, including formal clothing, red pens, churches used as polling places, light bulbs, and ibuprofen. This work has been featured in many media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Atlantic, Time, and the Huffington Post. Strangely, this has also led to him providing, quote, expert commentary on other subjects about which he knows little, such as the effect of prison uniforms on recidivism and the effect of workplace fashion on employees' confidence and work ethic. The highlight of his media career was probably being made fun of in a story by National Public Radio's Yuki Noguchi for dressing, quote, like a slob. More recently, he and his lab have begun a program of research at the intersection of social cognition and emerging technology. This work addresses how the capability of new technology to create both remoteness and intimacy influences the way we think and act. You can learn more about Abe at his site, Rutschick.com. That's Rutschick. You can follow him on Twitter at Abe Rutschick. Okay, here's the interview. Hi, Abe. Thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here, Zach. Thanks for having me.
So maybe we could start with the research you did about that involved the ladybug killing. Where did the idea for that originate, and why did you all pick that idea?
Yeah, that idea started so long ago, about before the actual paper was published. We started it in, I want to say, 2009, a year after I'd gotten to my academic job at CSUN, at Cal State Northridge, where I teach. My colleague Rob Yeomans, who now works for YouTube, who was down the hall at the time, we chatted about ideas all the time, and at some point, I don't even remember which of us had the initial idea, but we thought about, one of us had read an article about drone strikes, and we thought about a way to maybe study, you know, we immediately had this thought that, like, you know, killing remotely might be a different psychological process than killing close up. It just struck us both. We started chatting about it and wondered whether we could find some way to look at an analog of that in an experimental lab context. So yeah, that's really just started with the ultimate implication, as opposed to that being a kind of a, you know, down the road, downstream consequence. We really was inspired by it initially, you know, and then even though that was the inspiration, we weren't really trying to, like, replicate that experience. Obviously, warfare and actual killing of people in that context is not something you're going to be able to capture in a psych lab, at least not in this country in this time, you know, maybe back in the 50s when they could do anything. Yeah, so we started just, you know, batting ideas around. Rob left CSUN fairly soon after that, went to another academic job and then onto industry. But we stayed in touch on the idea. And over the years, we kind of built out a method for doing it. It took us, you know, no exaggeration, I think 6 years to kind of build a protocol that worked in terms of we constructed a specific apparatus to do the experiment. We had to work out a system that was believable but also ethical. Getting the approval from the Human Subjects Committee was non-trivial, as you can imagine. And so it took quite a bit of time just to set up. And you know, very fortunate to be at an institution that there's not as much publication pressure. You can take these sort of windmill tilting approaches to research.
So one thing I often wonder about studies that involve people asking subjects to engage in some bad or suspect behavior is, wouldn't some people in the study realize it was likely a psychology study and maybe some sort of setup? And is that at all a factor? And maybe I'm wrong on that. And maybe the fact that you still get different results shows that, you know, these things are not so much of a factor.
No, I think that's a really important point. It's definitely a factor, definitely something you have to consider. And a lot of the art and craft of doing this kind of work, psychologically realistic work, is in creating a setting that is psychologically real. Clearly, when you think about sort of generalizability from an experiment to a real life situation, you think about, you know, are these people representative of the population I care about? That kind of question. Probably not. They're students, but, you know, that's a concern. Is this, you know, to what extent can we go from this situation to a real situation? And that notion of ecological validity or being a psychologically real experience is crucial. Them not deducing that, you know, knowing what we're studying is really important. Understanding our hypotheses, whether it's a real killing or non-real killing, in the experimental design, super important. And I don't actually agree that if they knew what we were studying, and of course they knew it was an experiment, but it knew what we were studying and didn't think it was real or something like that, I don't think that would be valid. I think we'd be studying a different process involving a lot of sort of metacognitive stuff, right? That is not what we're really interested in. In this case, yeah, you need a cover story that works. And that's one reason why it took so long. Our cover story was, we told them that we were doing a human factors study, so like a user experience study. So our psych department historically had a big wing of it that was focused on that. So that's a plausible cover story. And we said, look, you know, there's lots of reasons why you might want to kill insects at scale. You can extract dye from them if they're colorful, or you can use them for DNA sampling. And so what we're doing is, you know, doing that one person at a time with a mortar and pestle is too cumbersome for an industrial context. And so we're looking to do it quickly. And so we have this set up with a conveyor belt and the bugs, and we're looking to test the usability of this thing. And we had them answer questions about usability and all that sort of stuff to sort of make that ruse real. We did have, I'm trying to think, so we've done actually three studies. One is published, the other two are not. So across all these studies, about 1,000 people have run through this protocol. There are people who don't believe. It's about a 3% rate of disbelief. Mm-hmm. And we do a careful debriefing afterwards where we say, anything, any comments on the study? Okay, cool. Anything weird about it? Okay, cool. Anything suspicious about it? It's called a funnel debriefing, where you kind of gradually get closer and closer to, like, all right, did you think it was real? You know, and they're like, now that you say that, no, I didn't. Exactly. So you kind of go all the way down. You evaluate at what point you have a coding scheme for that, and you're like, all right, this guy didn't believe. This guy didn't, and you toss out. We completely excluded from analysis people who we believe, based on our viewing of those responses, that they didn't. Didn't believe it was really happening.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the design itself is super realistic. So, you know, the machine is this big black box. It's like a toolbox, like a metal toolbox. There's a conveyor belt on top of it. The ladybugs, which are real live ladybugs, are sitting in little capsules, little plastic sort of hemispheres that have, like, paper taped on the bottom. You can see them. They're moving. They're real. The experimenter, sort of who's demonstrating it, says, okay, I'm going to show you how it works. I'm going to kill one ladybug. And they advance the conveyor belt using this controller. They drop it into the killing machine. They run the grinder that makes a loud grinding noise. It's like a computer fan on a nail. So it's super realistic. And then they reach into the back of it and they pull out a little output tray. And they show them a crushed up ladybug, which is not actually, it's not a real crusher. It's not real. But we previously had a ladybug that we were able to use. And it's convincing. They look at it and like, okay, now if you don't mind, just show you know how to use it, if you could just crush this Rice Krispie. And we give them a Rice Krispie in the same kind of capsule. And they crush the Rice Krispie. And then we take out the output tray again. It's all sleight of hand. It's two separate pre-prepared output trays.
Magic.
It's got crushed Krispie. It's got more plastic. It's got the bug in it. It's like, oh, okay. They believe it. Uh-huh. It's very convincing.
Interesting. Yeah, I was that was my one of my questions was, how do you set that up? And it sounds like a lot of work goes into making that believable. Yeah, interesting.
It took a lot of work. I called a friend of mine, a dear friend who's a set designer for theater. And I was like, hey, can you help me with this? And he's like, I'm not sure I want to get involved in this. You know, this is kind of scary. I mean, I was really asking a lot of folks for advice on how to make this realistic, how to make it work. It was not an easy process. It was long and painful. It's the kind of work that doesn't really get done anymore, just because, you know, science needs results sooner. Mm-hmm. You know, people want to get, you know, you want to get an answer. You can't, you know, look at we have a master's program, not a PhD program. So a graduate student, you know, that's three careers worth of graduate students. They're 2 year spans just in the design phase. So, you know, if the payoffs aren't there for most folks at a time that they can access them. So it's the kind of work that doesn't get done. It's the kind of stuff you used to see in the 50s and 60s a lot, some of the really neat classic studies. And certainly that's an inspiration for the work. And I'm, again, like I said before, lucky to be at a place where they tolerate these absurdities.
One thing I was wondering about that study was if you had done a follow-up study judging people's degrees of guilt from the two groups. I wonder if you would have seen interesting things about like how being more likely to kill things remotely and how that played into feeling bad about it. Maybe did you have something in your study?
We did. It's not in the published paper, so you wouldn't have seen it. So you've predicted it. But we did it in this paper. We did a bunch, right? So we did this paper, which is the one study. We replicated this, which an unpublished manuscript that we're been trying to get published and sort of sitting on the back burner as we keep trying. Everyone, the journals tend to say, well, we've done this already. What's new here? I'm like, well, we're replicating it. That's important, surely. We have some new questions showing why we think it's happening, and it's not quite convincing enough as novel. Which is a side issue in itself. Novelty is an interesting criterion because we want to believe that this stuff keeps working, right? But anyway, that in that one, we also followed up with some of those folks a month later and asked how guilty they still felt. And we looked at sort of trajectory and whether it differed, whether they did it, you know, in person or via Skype in those days. So whether they did it remotely versus in person. We also looked at, and we didn't really get a huge difference there. It's pretty hard to pin down. My guess, nothing significant statistically. My guess is that it, because they have different levels of feeling bad about it at the time, right? Mm-hmm. So people who are in person kill less and feel worse about it. People remote kill more and feel less bad about it. And so trying to look at those trajectories, they're not starting at the same spot, and mm-hmm. it's not quite clear that they should go at the same slope, right, if they are actually the same. You know, it got a little
complex.
Murky. We also looked at a moral foundations theory before and after they did it. So the question of like, does participating in this act change you in some way? Does it change your morality? Do you feel like it's less bad to kill animals after you kill a bunch of animals? You know, for that one, we had to delay our debriefing for a little bit. Also, they believed they did it, right? So the way we set it up, they had to kill at least two, and there were 10 on the conveyor belt. So now they didn't have to; they could, of course, stop at any time. But we said, you know, to give it a good test, you got to kill at least two. And so, you know, our dependent variable here is, did they kill just the two? Did they kill more, or did they kill all 10? By the way, interestingly, most people, you know, 2/3 of people either kill two or 10, right? You don't get a whole lot of, once you get going, you're going to keep going. You get a few who stop it. Very few stop at three, right? That doesn't happen. And some will stop at like 6 or 7, like, yeah, I'm done with this. Maybe just due to boredom. Our third study, we did all in person actually. And we looked at, so not remotely. So not looking at the remoteness question, but we looked at a bunch of personality variables to see what might predict it. We also got facial coding on their face while they were doing it. So we recorded their faces, and we can feed that into emotion coding software. Our first pass at that wasn't fruitful, but you know, that at some point we'll have some grad student who really wants to look at those data and figure it out. So, yeah, we've kind of tried to extract as much of out of these really hard to do studies as we can.
Yeah, as you say, it seems super complex because there's even this factor of like, once you do something, you kind of self-justify, you know, you justify your behavior and make peace with it in various ways. And it's kind of hard to know how that dynamic goes, and there's probably all sorts of factors even within that. And yeah, it seems super complex. Yeah,
it is. And we also asked people, by the way, like we described the scenario and showed people it, you know, showed a video of it and said, how many do you think you would kill if you were in this situation? And, you know, not surprisingly, they say they would kill very few. They actually say they would kill fewer in person than remote, even when we just sort of describe the situation to them. Mm. But there's a giant gulf between what they actually would do, what they say they would do, which is, not surprising, I suppose, but still interesting.
So when it came to getting those results out there and the mainstream press covering it a bit. Did you see, was there much, it seems like something that's theoretically interesting to the mainstream with how it regards to topical issues like drone killings and such. Did you see much interest in it? And did you, if so, did you see more or less than you expected?
Yeah, well, a little bit, but certainly less than I expected. This is a, you know, in my view, as I was doing it, it's clearly my favorite piece I've ever done. I'm immensely proud of it, if I'm being honest. I think it's really neat. I've done other things that have been more cited. This is barely cited. It is in a textbook, however, which is a huge something I'm super proud of. But it's not been cited much by other papers, which is like for academics, that's like our key metric. Like, is it getting cited? Who else is citing it? Very little. You know, I've got some stuff that's been cited hundreds of times. That's, you know, fine. You know, interesting. I don't do any work that I don't kind of like. If I don't really believe it, I'm not going to publish it. But this is not among the ones. I mean, this is way down on the list of how much it's been cited in terms of media and sort of conversation around it. The thing that gets cited most of my work is some work on wearing formal clothing. That's the one that gets cited the most. I take a call every like week or two or three about that. I mean countless interviews about
really?
The fact of wearing suits. Oh yeah, well, we all wear clothes, you know. But that stuff's cool, it's neat work, but like, and I'm super excited to be on to chat with anyone about this. That one was on NPR. That one was on I've been on NPR three times for some of these. It's crazy. But it's always been these like things that are sort of fun and frivolous,
more,
like
more pop culture.
Yeah, the clothing one. Red pens make you grade harsher. You know, that one, people, that was my first NPR hit back in like 2010. And, you know, not that that's not interesting work, but it is a little more. I mean, I do love studying stuff that matters for your everyday life, right? But it does seem less important than killing things. So I'm a little frustrated that this hasn't gotten a bit more.
Much of a downer.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it's a little scary. And, you know, it's a little controversial. I remember we applied for an internal grant to do some of the work. Now I'm definitely talking out of school, so to speak. How can I say this to be fair? Yeah, so I got some insider info. We didn't get the grant. I got some insider info from someone who I won't name, that someone on the internal committee was themselves a veteran and was enraged by the idea that that our work in the lab could possibly capture what it's like to be in combat. And I totally take that critique. I don't think that means that we shouldn't do the work. And I don't mean that, you know, but that's a legitimate, you know, concern. I don't know what it's like to face someone with, you know, who wants to kill me and kill them. That's wild. And I'm not suggesting it does. But I think that it's really hard to study this process. And I would counter with like, well, what else do you want me to do? I mean, we should clearly interview people and see what that experience is like qualitatively. We should clearly look at all sorts of ways to study this super important, fundamentally human process. Given the tools of my discipline of experimental social psychology, you know, maybe I could upgrade to Goldfish or something, but this is pretty much as far as I'm willing to go. And I think you can learn something useful from, I mean, people thought they were killing something. And it's not like a mosquito, it's a ladybug. They like it.
I can't see anything objectionable about your study because it's kind of hard to argue at an intuitive level. I mean, sitting in a room in Virginia and pushing a button on a drone to kill someone is clearly, you know, it would clearly seem to be easier than being actually at that place and doing it yourself, you know.
You'd have to think so.
I just, it's kind of hard to imagine that being objectionable or like controversial to
me. Well, the controversy, I guess, would be around me saying that this reasonably replicates what that is like, knowing you're ending someone's life, a human's life. And certainly I could have written the paper in a way that would have been unfair and sort of presumed something that isn't right. I mean, look, if I had been, if I had a different pre-science career and had been a Marine, I think that person's objection would be easy enough to dismiss. I'd say, no, I know. And, you know, but it's, I that's a reasonable critique.
It's science.
It's a reasonable critique. I'm not going to blame someone for thinking that I don't know what I'm talking about in this instance. I don't know what that's like. I've boxed, I've been punched in the face and punched people in the face who wanted to punch me in the face and so on. That's not the same either. It's not the same as killing. So, you know, I take that critique.
So I'd written a piece about social media and social media effects and about how there are inherent aspects of internet communication that lend themselves to amplifying our divides and amplifying some bad us versus them thinking. And I referenced your study in there as a way to make the point that if it's easier to kill from a distance, then it's understandably easier to do many bad behaviors, antisocial behaviors, like threatening people online, insulting people online, generally treating people badly online. So in short, everything bad and antisocial, presumably would be easier to do at a distance. And I'm curious if you'd agree with that interpretation? And is it something that you've extrapolated from your study to other things in life?
Yeah. No, well, first, thanks for citing it. Now it's been cited twice. No, just kidding. I definitely have agreed with that thought. I mean, I thought about it some. I should point out that there's work that looks at this quite directly, like actually does textual analysis on more and less anonymous channels and looks at the effect of anonymity that the internet affords in a much more direct way. So that speaks to that even more. But mine does, I think, add another brick to that wall. Particularly when we're talking about more deeply problematic behaviors like cyberbullying and suicide baiting and things along those lines. I mean, it gets pretty grim sometimes. And there would be people who have been prosecuted.
Swatting.
You know, swatting for sure with real consequences. I feel like there, people are so, I feel like people don't realize that's serious until it is. But like there, it's almost this disconnect between their understanding. Oh, that's a funny prank. It's like delivering 10 pizzas to their house and then someone's dead.
Well, right. It's like when things are distant, they're less real. I mean, it's like, well, what could happen? I don't really know. It's kind of abstract. It's
exactly it's far underscores away. The point. Underscores the point. Yeah, for sure. And like, yeah, I mean, there have been people that believe there's a woman in Boston, if I'm not mistaken, who is convicted of aiding the suicide of her boyfriend, and it was a sort of a manslaughter conviction of some kind, then entirely through online experiences. So yeah, I think broadly, I think absolutely. It's funny, you know, we're definitely not the only folks to think of this. I mean, Louis C.K. has a bit about it, even where he sort of talks about the road rage that people will do, like with a pane of glass between two people, you'll say anything horrible about somebody, but you'd never do that at the same distance without that pane of glass. Imagine turning to someone in an elevator and screaming these sort of horrible things. You know, it's definitely true. And every possible thing we can introduce that decreases our intimacy, increases our sense of remoteness and distance, psychological distance, I think is going to lead to problems.
Yeah.
By and large, it makes me think of lots of stuff. I mean, there's lots of good psychological reasons for this that people have looked at a bunch. I mean, it's reasonable. We want to get credit for our good deeds and you know, avoid blame for our bad ones. I do an exercise in my class every year where I say, look, if you were invisible for a day, for 24 hours, what would you do? And I have them anonymously write it down. And then I read them and it's like, rob a bank, rob three banks, go to Disneyland for free, kick somebody in the pants, go to Area 51. And they're all like, you know, it's pranks, it's spying, it's theft. And then you get a few people who are like, they don't understand that like they could do most of these things visible. And they're like, I'd go to France. I'm like, okay.
Well, and that's just what they say. Imagine what they're not saying too.
Yeah. Well, there's that too. And then you get 1 out of 100 sweet souls who are just like, I leave cupcakes on my friend's door. And like, you know, someone will be like, I'll cure cancer. I'm like, man, I'm not sure your visibility is the obstacle here.
Oh my God.
But it's great. And I've done it for my classes. I've done it for corporate audiences when I speak in those settings. And they're real bad. they, you know. But it's striking, right? And I don't blame. This is not like human nature is bad when left unsupervised. I don't think that's the lesson here. I think it's that is this very reasonable thing. It's like, here's a unique opportunity to not experience culpability for our actions. Let's go. You know,
it's tempting.
I set it up as a right. But no, you know, you're not going to be invisible whenever you want. You'd probably act differently. It's a special chance to be naughty. In the setting of online though, yeah, we can at will be pretty invisible and say mean stuff to people. Mm-hmm. And it's a chance. It's kind of titillating in real life. If I started, you know, screaming at somebody, there might be consequences and, you know, reputationally or otherwise, this is a chance to do this. Woohoo, you know? And so, yeah, you do get that. And pretty much every behavior is going to get worse, when you crank those things up and you take away that accountability. And it's not just, I'm worried about the consequences. There's some psychological theory to suggest the sort of notion of self-awareness, it has an impact internally, right? So if I'm conscious of who I am, at the time, if I'm thinking of, you know, I'm very self-aware, that's going to make me better. There's a famous study, which, you know, it's almost into the apocryphal territory because I don't think it's been replicated, but kids stealing Halloween candy. You know, if there's a mirror behind the bowl, they're less likely to steal the candy because they're sort of like, oh, I shouldn't do this. My moral compass is restored by seeing my own face, right? Whereas if you're sort of masked, anonymous in a big group, you're more likely to misbehave. So yeah, I broadly agree. I think it has implications for, I don't want to be too grandiose about my particular study, but you know, this and related work has implications for how we function in a workplace, particularly in the COVID era. And I wonder whether that's something we could observe more broadly. I mean, there's so many things have changed. It's hard to pinpoint, you know, a cause and effect here. But, you know, we're doing everything through email and through Zoom, and so fewer things face to face. What does that do? I think it's got implications for all that work. The broad point has been belabored and made, though. You know, like, anonymous is bad. Remote is bad. It tends to make us worse.
A small edit here. I took out some talking that Abe and I did on the subject of fake and anonymous social media accounts. We talked about how social media companies don't have an incentive to reduce anonymity. They don't want to put up more hoops for users to jump through. They don't want to hurt their market share and make it harder for potential customers to join. Facebook, for example, deletes about 1 to 2 billion fake accounts per quarter, which gives a sense of the problem. I talked about how I blamed Facebook for not doing more to cut down on fake accounts, because even though they claim it's against their terms and conditions to create a fake, deceptive account, they have very few obstacles on signing up that would prevent people from creating these fake accounts. While I'm on the subject, I wanted to mention that I've done some independent research into fake Facebook accounts. That research was featured in 2017 in a New York Times article titled, "Facebook Says It's Policing Fake Accounts, But They're Still Easy to Spot." Later, some other research I did was featured in 2018 in the Washington Post in an article titled, "When a Stranger Takes Your Face, Facebook's Failed Crackdown on Fake Accounts." I was even invited on the Chris Hayes show to talk about that work, but I missed an email they sent and I missed that opportunity. If you want to know more about this work, I have some articles about that fake account research on my blog at Medium, which you can find by searching online for Zach Elwood Research Medium. I'll jump to where Abe starts to talk about a study he did involving autonomous vehicles.
I did a study, a series of studies back in a few years back with a wonderful master's student named Ryan McManus, who's now a PhD student at Boston College. He led these studies. So I was there as an advisor, and I did my share of work, but he was the boss of this. He's a moral psychologist that he studies how people make morally relevant decisions. I had this burgeoning interest in technology. And so the intersection of that is like, how do we make moral decision making in a technologically advanced context? So we're talking here about the question of self-driving cars, of AI controlled vehicles, AVs, and how you judgments of guilt if there's an accident in different scenarios. And one of the scenarios we were looking at was this sort of scenario where sometimes these cars will have to make decisions about what they do. These are somewhat contrived, arguably, but sometimes we'll be in a situation where you're going down the road quickly and someone runs across the road, and do you hit that person or do you swerve out of the way, having some risk to you? I've actually been in this, it's artificial, yes, but I've been in this situation actually in my car before. I was driving once down a road and it is this misty morning, and it's about 7:30 in the morning on a weekend, so it's quiet, heading out to get some breakfast, and a truck was coming towards me with a ladder dangling horizontally, unbeknownst to this fellow, obviously, off the back of his truck, like off the tailgate, blocking both lanes. And I'm driving towards this guy. I'm like, is that really happening? Oh, that's really happening. There's a ladder across the road. And this street happened to be, I mean, it was like, you couldn't write this in an experimental stimulus and have it be believable, but this truly was. No sidewalk. The thing on the right was like lawns of people's houses. Do I get hit by a ladder at 40 miles an hour for each of us, or do I drive blind onto someone's lawn where there could be a child? And I did the worst thing, which is like the halfway in between, where I kind of basically like kept going straight, slowed down, and kind of like shirked my shoulder, ducked down a little, also moved to the right slightly. I probably the worst killed both sets of people.
Did both?
Yeah, right, exactly. So the ladder shatters my side mirror, thankfully, because it swung up by the wind. Anyway, these things do happen. These seemingly artificial dilemmas are real
every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think so, but it happened to me. What do? Do you preserve the most life, the classic utilitarian thing? Do I swerve to avoid two people and then potentially put one person in the car at risk, or do you preserve the driver at all costs? Mm-hmm. There's some work on this that came along around the same time as ours, where someone basically was like did some work showing that people think that others ought to make the utilitarian choice, that what you ought to do is have a car that saves the most lives possible. But I would prefer to ride in one that saves me.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's a very famous paper. It got cited a lot of times, and I'm just like, wow, yep, that is true. And I don't know if we needed the study to know that.
Right. Okay. It kind of ties into the ladybug killing, because it's like, I don't mind death when it's a distant, remote thing, but if it involves me, I'm very particular.
Exactly. Particular if I am the person dying. Yeah. So yeah, I don't want to mock those guys. They've done some really cool other work extending that and like looking at the demographics of who's crossing the street. Is it like three old ladies and a cat versus like, you know, two young men, or like who would you sacrifice to save whom, and that sort of stuff. They've done some really cool work on that. So that was kind of the idea, this sort of classic trolley dilemma. So if Liz is not familiar with it, there's this trolley problem, a trolley dilemma that goes back to a philosopher named Philippa Foot back in the 60s. And this is the idea of there's a train or trolley going down the tracks. There's five people on this track. Do we pull a lever to divert the trolley to not kill those five people, but instead kill one person on another track? And you know, people generally make that utilitarian choice and do pull the lever. The reason it's tricky is that we're now taking an action to kill someone who was not imperiled before this, right? If we just stay still, these guys die. But we make the utilitarian choice more often than not. There's some fun variations, which actually tie back to our idea of intimacy that we were talking about before on remoteness, where the footbridge version of this, where instead of pulling a lever to divert it, you push a guy off a footbridge onto the tracks, and the train hits that guy instead. And people don't tend to do that, right? They tend to not make the utilitarian choice. Now, you can't just push an innocent guy who is nowhere near the tracks onto the tracks. Which is interesting. The same number of lives lost, but I don't know. I guess we're blaming the other fellow for being near a train track. It's really interesting. And then when you take that another step further and you say, okay, if I push this guy off the train tracks using a long stick, people are more likely to do that than do it by hand.
The distant thing.
That's exactly it, right? The distance does seem to matter. The intimacy of like putting your hands on a person and pushing them to their death is really seems to be a driving factor here. The long poking device, on the other hand, is adds just enough remoteness. I think that's fascinating line of work. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the sort of framework from which we approached this. We said, okay, this is the scenario. Either the person is driving and makes the selfish choice or the selfless choice. We have an AI controlled system that was programmed by the manufacturer of the car. They make the selfish choice, the selfless choice. We have an AI system that was programmed by the driver when they bought the car. So that's the same set of things. And then we had some override conditions. So the person had a pre-programmed thing that they chose to be selfish, but then in the moment of truth, they hit their override switch and behave selflessly, or the reverse. They decided that they were going to be selfless, but then when it came down to it, they were actually selfish. They hit the override switch. So all those conditions in place, the different outcomes. You find what you sort of expect, which is that in the manual condition, of course, the driver gets a lot of blame or praise for their actions, and that is diminished when it's programmed by them and it's an AI, and that's still further diminished when it's programmed not by them, by the manufacturer, and it's an AI. We saw some interesting stuff around the override switch. If you go back on your previous selfless actions, right? So I decided to behave selflessly, but in the moment I just couldn't do it, and I decided to be selfish. That's actually even worse than being selfish the whole time, which is sort of cool. This sort of lapsed saint condition, which is really neat, and the reverse too, for being selfish and then deciding, you know what, I can't do it, I can't kill this person who's in front of me, and they act selflessly. That's actually better than being selfless the entire time. So it's kind of neat. I think there's something in the idea that what you do in the moment is at the moment of truth is more diagnostic of what you're really like, your true character. I think that's probably behind that. So we did that, and we've done some interesting follow-ups on like casting blame to different agents. Like, do you blame the manufacturer, the driver, and the how much do you blame each of these entities?
I think that whole area is so much more complicated than I think a lot of people realize. And it was about 10 years ago, I made a bet with a friend, a $500 bet with a friend I bet that we would not see fully autonomous vehicles, with no driver at all on public roads for more than 15 years. And the reason I thought that was because I thought the technology would be good enough to do it. But I thought that I was skeptical of these like more complicated human factors. You know, for one thing, I thought it was underestimated how fully autonomous vehicles are perceived as more freaky and creepy than I think many people think for many people, especially older people. That was one factor. And then the other reason for me was that, you know, some of these things you're talking about where the moral and legal complications of how these things would actually work are so much more complicated than they seem on the surface, you know, like who makes those decisions? Is it legislated? You know, if it's a black box AI system that you don't really know the workings of, is that ever really workable if you can't say exactly what it's doing? And a lot of these AI systems are kind of black box situations where the machine learning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's all these factors that make it a lot more ethically and legally complicated than I think is perceived. And I haven't really been following it, the actual state of things recently, but I wonder, you know, how much that has held up the stuff versus the technology itself. I don't really know, but yeah, it's super complicated.
Yeah. Well, I think at this point I would have made that same bet with you, and I think you're going to win your bet. So, you know, if I think about, you know, how my views have changed as well. I mean, I think a lot of driverless miles have been driven even on public roads actually. There's a guy in the car, you know, who theoretical ability to take control of that thing. They're not a means of transport that anyone can just have access to. The full self-driving features on Tesla are always being disabled and re-enabled and things along those lines. You know, we don't do well. I should have Ryan McManus talking about moral judgment, not me. But we don't do well when there are multiple targets. We like simplicity. Think of an insurance situation, right? They really like to know who's at fault on the accident. Sometimes some states have multiple fault. I got into an accident in New York one time, and they're like, "Well, it's 20% your fault." I'm like, "Was it? I don't think so." You know, I guess it was raining, and I could have been going slower. You know, but we don't do that very well. We kind of like assign fault to someone for a lot of these things. That's how, you know, think about when you're wronged interpersonally or something happens to you that's bad, you look around to see whose fault it was. We want someone to blame. And usually it's one entity. It's not like when we look for blame, we don't like, darn this complex system of interacting variables in a nuanced way made my day worse. Like, it's just not how this works, right? When we have what is clearly a complicated system of interacting nuanced variables, it's not quite clear how people are going to just be able to kind of get their heads around that legislatively, you know, morally in the court of public opinion, financially when it comes down to an insurance claim. So yeah, I do think those social obstacles are very real, independent of the technological advantages. With that technological challenges. With that said, the worst of these systems is better than the best human driver now. Like, I think it's actually, I think one reason why I think there's a mistake here, which is that change is hard. We tend to get blamed for action more than inaction, right? If I'm sitting there and I just hold on to my money and inflation happens and I gradually lose some, or I hold on to my money and I don't invest in crypto and it goes up a lot, like, I'm so stupid, I wish I'd done those things. Like, you're like, okay, I guess I missed an opportunity. That's not great. On the other hand, if I put money in and it goes down, now I feel terrible. And everyone looks at me like, dummy, you know, we tend to get blamed more for actions and praised more for actions without considering what the inaction is or what the baseline is. We are in a situation now where a tremendous amount of people die in their cars. It's a lot. It's really bad. I believe the sixth leading cause of death. Maybe that's within certain age brackets or something along those lines. I looked at it several years ago, but like, it's a problem.
35 to 40,000 people a year in the US.
Fair amount. I mean, not that that would, as we've seen, just because a lot of people are dying from something, that doesn't necessarily mean we'll take the appropriate actions to stop it. But it is clearly a thing that is an issue. It's also a tremendous cost, infrastructure, culturally, environmentally, and so on. A very bad AI driver is going to reduce those deaths. And I think, yeah, we're quite far. I mean, the first time the AI does something stupid that a human like wouldn't have done, you know, we're going to be like, oh, well, this is no good. Never mind the fact that like it wouldn't have done the 20 stupid things that humans do. So it's a tricky thing, and a lot of it has to do with our embracing of the status quo and our bias towards that.
Yeah, it kind of gets into existentialist thought too, where it's like we're always making decisions, even when we think we're not making decisions, we are making decisions. So you and I initially started talking to each other because of a poker-related paper. It was a pretty well-known study by Michael Slepian. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Slepian.
And it, and that study got a lot of mainstream press, speaking of things getting a lot of mainstream press. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. One thing I was interested in was, as we were talking about with your study getting press, that got a lot of press. And it struck me as it was because of the kind of sexiness of poker tells and how poker tells hold kind of a mystique and excitement in the public's eye, and maybe especially in America with the prevalence of poker and culture. And do you think I'm right about why that got so much attention? Maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. It did get some attention. It's been cited a decent amount. I'm thinking it didn't get nearly as much attention as some, but yeah, it did get a decent amount of attention.
Well, I guess Michael not citing, but in the mainstream, because it was on NPR. And,
yeah, Michael was on NPR for it.
And
it was
and good, several other things. Yeah.
Yep, it was. It did get some. A good amount. You're right. Not as much as Four Book Lily, but it did
more,
get some.
Was it more than Ladybugs though?
Yes, it did. Quite a bit more than Ladybugs, exactly. Okay. Not
less than the formal clothing, but more than Ladybugs.
Way less than that, but yeah, okay, no, gotcha. Indeed it did.
We got to scale these things, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It continues to resonate in popular culture, actually, that study. I don't know if anyone's read Maria Konnikova's wonderful recent book on her poker journey, mm-hmm. But she has this scene in the book where she goes up to Eric Seidel. Again, I'm not sure how poker savvy our audience is, but goes to Eric Seidel and like wants to recruit him as her coach. And she like, as her trump card, she pulls out of her bag this like paper that apparently no one has read. And I'm fairly certain. I haven't had a chance to ask her yet, but I am more than 50% confident that was that piece, the Slepian piece.
I think she mentions that in her book because she talks.
I don't know if she mentions that was the one she pulled out.
She talks about Slepian's piece later in the book. I think so. It's probably the same. Yeah,
that's my hunch about my detective work. So at any rate, Michael was my undergraduate back when I was teaching at Syracuse as a visiting professor early in my career. He was a film major and took my social psych class and decided to shift gears and do social psych. And now he's done, I don't know, 10 times as much as I have. He's a superstar. He's actually a brief plug. He's got a book that's coming out just now, yesterday, available for pre-order. It's called The Secret Life of Secrets. He's a secrecy researcher, and his book is coming out. I'm delighted to get that pre-order in soon. So anyway, that study, the origins of it. I mean, I'll describe it. And yes, I agree with your broad sentiment that the mystique of poker and the sexiness of poker is a big factor here. The study, he had done the work with another student and his advisor and kind of brought me aboard largely to make sure that there weren't any horrible gaffes in his description of the rules of hold'em. So just kind of the poker consultant, which, it's been some writing edits and so on too, but I didn't have much to do with the actual running of the studies. The work is really neat though, and it's in a very prominent journal. That's the other thing that I think helped a lot, is that it's in arguably the best journal that social psychologists publish in outside of like Science. It's in a journal called Psychological Science, which is a great journal, very high profile. And so, it's basically had lay people watch videos from World Series of Poker footage and essentially evaluate it. And there's a few quirks and stuff, but basically they're evaluating hand quality on just like a liquor type scale, like strong hand, weak hand.
Hand strength. Hand strength.
Yeah. And again, it's done in a context free way, right? We can talk about the flaws of the study if you'd like, there's plenty. We're not looking at the whole, I mean, anyone who studies poker knows that there's, the strength of a hand in the abstract is not like a meaningful thing here. We look at hand strength by looking at like, the percent chance to win from that point on. But of course, you don't know what your percent chance to win is because you don't know the other person's cards. Maybe you do if you have the nuts, but like often that's a question that is unknown to you. We looked at people rated how strong the hands were as they watched a clip of the person placing the bet, like moving the chips in. We altered the videos in one of three ways. One, we didn't in one case in the control. In another condition, we showed just the face, sort of like the shoulders up. And in the other, we showed just the arms, shoulders down. And what we find is that people are basically at chance if they look at the whole body. They can't tell what's strong and what's weak from watching them bet. They are worse than chance, statistically worse than chance, if they look at just the face. And they are better than chance if they look at everything but the face. So if they look at the hands, arms, moving, right? Mm-hmm. The idea being that when we're making a bet in poker or doing anything in poker, we're concealing and maybe even deceiving actively how strong our hand is. We think everyone talks about a poker face. Not too many people talk about poker shoulders. We try to stay stoic or even, again, misleading. And the evidence suggests, indeed, misleading. But we exert less conscious control, or whether we don't do it or we're unable to do it, on our hands, on our sort of motions. I mean, people try, of course, but we're apparently worse at that. It's the smoothness with which we put our chips in seems to predict strength, and people are probably not aware of whether they're doing this well or poorly. And lay people can pick up on this and get useful information.
A small note here. Regarding Michael Slepian's poker study, soon after that came out, I had written a critique of that study. You can find it on my readingpokertells.com site or by searching for Zach Elwood Criticism Slepian Poker Study. If you're interested in poker or in poker-related scientific studies, you might enjoy it. Back to the interview. You did another poker-related study too, right? Is that right?
Yeah, way back with my colleague Dustin Calvillo on hindsight bias in poker. So looking at hindsight bias is this phenomenon, this sort of I knew it all along effect, where you mm-hmm. recall your previous predictions as being closer to what actually happened than they really were. It's a well-known, very easy to demonstrate cognitive bias in that sort of cognitive psych literature. And what we found is that expertise attenuates aspects of that bias. So the aspects of bias are attenuated, other aspects are not. The role of expertise in biases is really interesting. Sometimes expertise can solve certain biases, sometimes it doesn't. And knowing that is really useful. So again, poker is a somewhat narrow domain of endeavor, but at least in that domain, we have an interesting effect where expertise sometimes helps and sometimes doesn't, mm-hmm. which is kind of neat. We have another study actually that unpublished. I was looking it up before we chatted because I wanted to remind myself of it that another student did with me, Johnny Gukasian, did his thesis on this work, and we haven't published it. Johnny moved on to industry and is working in market research. So the incentive to get the work done to make that into a publishable manuscript is not as there as it would have been. We looked there at sort of like the sort of embodiment in poker. So like another round of the study I did with Michael Slepian, kind of looking at what people's hands and arms are doing as they act and how that affects strength. And we found that like how far people moved their hands, right? So like the literal distance they moved their hands predicted the strength of their cards. Basically nothing else in this particular study did. So there's clearly something.
So was it farther? Were you saying it was how far they put the bet into the pot?
The physical distance they moved the chips, yeah.
The farther it was related to more relaxation
strength.
Yeah,
okay. Cut out for one second as you're saying. Yeah, that's right. So the further they put it, the stronger it was. That's what we found there.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Now that's really interesting. I want to talk to you more about that later. So let's see. Is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned?
I guess the only other study we haven't really discussed, this is going to be a little out of order, I suppose, but we talked a lot about social media and polarization in the context of my anonymity work, my remoteness work. I have done some work directly examining polarization that might be germane. The one that sort of most prominent of those, I actually had this really interesting trajectory around where I did it back in 2009, and it lay dormant. A few people cited it. I don't think I did any media on it. This past election cycle, 2020, it Adam Grant tweeted it. Adam Grant is a well-known industrial organizational psychologist, sort of a famous fellow in our field. And it immediately went completely bananas. Hundreds of thousands of people are talking about it. It was one of the most cited papers in social psychology that year.
Oh, wow.
It was discussed on Twitter. Like, there's a thing called Altmetric that tracks those things. And, I started seeing this thing go bananas, getting all the people were talking to me, hey, your study's going bananas. And I started looking, and it was really interesting to see. So that one has got some prominence. That's the one where we look at maps and how looking at different colored maps affect people's perceptions of polarization. So if you look at a classic red and blue election map, the Democrats winning the states are colored blue and the Republicans winning the states, it's colored red. You could do that. That's one depiction you could use. But you could also go with a red-blue blend and use a color purple appropriate to their share of votes. You could do that at a county level too, and like show the rich spectrum of differences in states or something along those lines. There's a million different sort of ways to represent this, but we choose this. The most prominent that we tend to see is this red blue.
The most polarizing.
Thing. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, it does tell you the election math, which is kind of what we want to know that night. And I had people look at one map or the other map and then make judgments about polarization, about stereotyping of the political views of people in different states, about the ability of people to affect outcomes and the sort of efficacy of voting. I had a version of it where and you get what you'd expect, right? But then I had a version where I printed the vote share on the map. Like, the numbers are there. These guys are 54, 39, you know, with some not voting for either candidate, right? Right on the map. And it made no difference whatsoever. You know, the colors dominate the vote numbers. Like, they're literally asking the question of, like, you know, how, if you're a randomly chosen person from Texas, how conservative are they? And the numbers right in front of them, doesn't matter. You know, the color rules. And so that was an interesting study, and it's gotten some play. I think there's
that's great.
We have a lot to say about polarization as a field, and I think it's something we're not going to stop looking at anytime soon. It's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, you have quite a few polarization studies, and I'll put some links to those in the page about this episode too. And that's really interesting because, I mean, so much of the polarization stuff is about these simplistic perceptions. And I was reading Peter Coleman's book recently about polarization. I think it was called The Way Out, and he talks about, you know, one of the main strategies for mediation and conflict resolution between two conflicting groups is to highlight the complexity of the situation, right? Because it destroys these kind of simplistic narratives that we have. And I mean, so much of this, the polarization stuff, is related to these kind of like, all of this group or all of this place is like this, you know, and yeah, kind of related to liberals saying bad stuff about Georgia or whatever, or Texas. And I'm like, you know, close to half of those people are liberals, you know, like, it gets into
heck with you. Kentucky is right out. It's like
fuck them. It's like, it's just these simplistic. And so I think that map thing is super interesting because showing the complexity, you know, going into granularity on the maps, you know, and how everything is so much more nuanced and complex on a map even can give you that sense of, you know, things are just not simple. People are not simple. Things are all these shades of things. You know?
Yeah. And the challenge, of course, there, and I think if that's the way out, if the way out is to understand complexity and emphasize complexity, I think that's interesting. I mean, people hate doing that. Yeah. Is the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Right. We have a very strong drive for understanding and clarity and closure and that sort of thing. And I think, that's a tough way out. It's better than the sort of crude, you know, we're all Americans, damn it, let's unite. That doesn't work.
That's simplistic too. Yeah, it's like that doesn't work for the same reasons. It's like nobody wants to hear that, and they view that as simplistic too. So it's like, yeah, highlighting the nuance and the complexity is one route. Yeah
The speaker also matters too. If someone in your group or someone else is the one talking, that's a big deal,
right?
But even still, it's pretty easy for these things to actually not merely fail but actually backfire if done by the wrong person incorrectly. Is the challenge. It is grim, and it's not going away anytime soon, and I wonder what those paths are. I mean, people are testing interesting interventions where they get people together to sort of agree on something. You know, something small that they can like agree on and agree that everyone would agree on or whatever it is. And like these sort of even mundane things,
bread tastes good.
Ideally something that is a political issue of some kind, right? It could be something somewhat substantive, like Americans should be able to file their income taxes with accurate information provided by the government for free. Like, most people actually agree with that. That there's very few. It's funny, actually, in the old days, meaning like 10 years ago, even, there are all sorts of issues that are considered apolitical. Like, you could use them as stimuli that are apolitical, and like sort of like science, trust in science was one, voter participation was another. And now, like, I can't think of two things that are more polarizing. It's really striking.
As things ramp up, everything starts getting sucked into the vortex of animosity and polarization.
It does seem to be the case. So pretty soon the TurboTax will get sucked in I'm sure.
Yeah, I really don't think there's anything you couldn't theoretically suck into that us versus them vortex. Like, I was, you know, even like you can imagine seatbelts, you know, or speed limits was one I was playing around with, if, you know, imagining how speed limits would become polarized, and you can imagine it becoming polarized in on two different, you know, two different ways depending on how things went. It's like none of these things are off limits in theory. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, is like the hypothetical world, the counterfactual world, where, like, you know, what if this had been reversed? What if it was the right was sort of driving for more vaccination?
Exactly. And
very easy to imagine. I do think that's absolutely viable. In fact, I am a little surprised that's not how it went, given that Trump was in power when this stuff was going on. But of course, what things happened the way they did. It's hard to construct those narratives, but it's in this case, I think it's an entirely plausible one. And yeah, you can suck it all in. We're built for that kind of conflict, as you pointed out yourself, right? I mean, that the us versus them lens is something that we are designed evolutionarily to see things through.
Well, thanks, Abe. This has been really interesting, and I think you do some really interesting work, you and your lab. So thanks for coming on and talking about it.
Thanks so much for having me, Zach. It's been a pleasure.
That was an interview with psychology researcher Abe Rutschick. His site is at rutschick.com, and his Twitter handle is Abe Rutschick. Again, if you want to see some of the studies discussed in this talk, go to behavior-podcast.com and look for the page for this episode. If you're interested in learning more about my PokerTales work, that's at readingpokertells.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on iTunes or another platform, and please share it with your friends. I may not be able to work on the podcast that often in the future, just due to me not making any money on it and it taking a good amount of my time. So any encouragement you can give me is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.